loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, we talk about North Korea and the possibility, perhaps the probability, that the summit between Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un, the leader of North Korea, will indeed take place. It's planned for June 12th in Singapore. General Kim Jong-chol is one of Kim Jong-un's closest advisors, and he has arrived in the United States to talk with the Trump administration and possibly Donald Trump himself. And then today we continue, as we always do on Tuesday, our weekly series on the economy. It's called False Prophets, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism with Daniel Sankey.
But before we get to those two stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, the Trump administration over the past several days has tried to defend itself against allegations that it has lost track of 1,500 undocumented children placed in temporary care. The accusations come on the heels of news reports that the Department of Homeland Security has implemented a policy of separating undocumented parents from their children. But the truth is that the policy dates from the Obama administration, and at this point in his presidency, Obama deported far more people than Trump has. Next, Italy's current political situation is in a state of chaos. Just days after two populist parties, the Five Star Movement and the far-right League Party, agreed to form a new government, the deal fell apart and President Sergio Mattarella has called for new elections. The two parties are expected to win even more seats in the next parliament. Then, Colombians have failed to elect a president outright, setting the stage for a bitter runoff between two frontrunners from opposite ends of the political spectrum, while a fragile peace process with leftist former rebels hangs in the balance. And then, electronic incarceration, the use of ankle bracelets and other monitoring devices on released prisoners, are popular government alternatives to prison. But are they really that different? The devices have turned prisoners' homes into prisons. In addition, prisoners are charged a daily fee for electronic incarceration, and if they can't pay for it, they go right back. And finally, Harvard University's T.H. Chan School of Public Health released a study this morning saying that the government's estimate of 64 deaths in Puerto Rico from last year's Hurricane Maria grossly underestimated the true number. The report puts the number of deaths at over 4,600, many of them because of delayed medical care. And in other headlines, Israel has carried out a wave of airstrikes in Gaza, hitting 35 targets that its military claims are positions of the Palestinian factions Hamas and Islamic Jihad. The Israeli strikes followed rocket fire launched from Gaza into southern Israel that caused no casualties and was itself retaliation for earlier Israeli strikes on Palestinian observation posts along the border. Tensions in Gaza have been at a boiling point since the Israeli military carried out repeated attacks against protesters participating in the Great March of Return. Political forces in Libya have reached an agreement to hold national elections on December 10th. The agreement is a product of negotiations held in Paris and attended by various Libyan political factions, governmental bodies, and international organizations. The country has been in a state of chaos with several competing governments since a U.S. and NATO-led operation in 2011 that overthrew the government of former leader Muammar al-Qaddafi. Starbucks is closing 8,000 stores across the country today for several hours in order to conduct racial bias training with its employees. The training was organized in response to a widely publicized incident at a Starbucks in Philadelphia, where a store employee called the police on two black men moments after they had sat down to wait for a friend to arrive. Many activists, however, say that training doesn't go far enough to address the systemic issues related to policing and private property that the Philadelphia incident highlights. And ABC has canceled the hit sitcom Roseanne following star Roseanne Barr's racist tweet about senior Obama administration advisor Valerie Jarrett. Barr also tweeted today about conspiracy theories related to George Soros. The reboot of the classic sitcom cast Roseanne as a Trump supporter, and the show has been the subject of much political controversy. Those are today's headlines. Next up, we take a look at a potential and very possible U.S. DPRK summit. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and clear.
Now we turn to Korea and the possibility of a summit meeting between Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un, the leader of North Korea. One of North Korea's top leaders is arriving today in the United States for talks with the Trump administration, officials from the Trump administration, and possibly with the president himself on kickstarting the U.S. DPRK summit originally planned for June 12th in Singapore. General Kim Jong-chol is one of Kim Jong-un's closest advisors and is a former chief of North Korean intelligence service. We're joined from New Zealand by author and professor Tim Beal. His most recent book is Crisis in Korea. And we're joined from Honolulu by Christine Ahn. She is a co-founder of the Korea Policy Institute and the international coordinator of Women Cross DMZ. Christine and Tim, welcome back to Loud and Clear.
Thanks, Brian.
Good to be back.
Thank you for joining. Christine Ahn, let's start with you. I mean, a really tumultuous week. Donald Trump canceled the summit last week. He sent a letter, a public letter to Kim Jong-un and to the DPRK leadership. Obviously, if he didn't write the entire letter, he had a big hand in it. The DPRK responded with what is perceived by the Trump administration and perhaps by all observers as a conciliatory measure. Let's keep this going. Christine, is this summit going to actually happen?
It looks like it, you know, all indications seem to point that it is going to happen. We know that there was the secret meeting between Moon and Kim last Saturday, and followed by a meeting of U.S. officials in Panmunjom, Song Kim, Allison Hooker from the NSC, and now Kim Jong-chol's trip to the United States, the first time that a senior DPRK official has met with officials at the White House, I think, in 18 years. So it seems like all signs that the bet is on, the deal is on. So we'll have to see. It's been what we consider on the International Women's Delegation to Korea last week, whiplash diplomacy. But it would be absolutely ridiculous if at this juncture the Trump administration decides not to proceed with the talks.
Tim Beal, I have a question for you. As I say this all the time, I'm a casual observer of Korean issues. And, you know, I get my news basically from the New York Times, the Washington Post, a couple of alternative sites. And everybody's talking about this grand idea of denuclearization and diplomatic relations and everything's going to be great and Trump's going to get the Nobel Peace Prize. But what really are we looking at here? What should we expect to come out of this and still call it a successful summit?
Well, what we want out of it, of course, is some measure of peace and security for North Korea. The American concentration on denuclearization, of course, misses the point because it is a bilateral discussion. So we've got to consider what both sides want. Nuclear weapons for North Korea, as for the United States, for the matter, is a deterrent. So you have a deterrent for a purpose. And the North Koreans would be saying, if that purpose goes away, in other words, if the United States drops its hostility policy, drops the economic warfare, the political warfare, the military threats, et cetera, then it doesn't need its deterrent. What that actually means, we don't know, and perhaps that will be hammered out at the summit or perhaps after the summit. I think the summit is probably going to be a PR exercise, a bit of face-saving, so both sides can go away and claim it a success. But underneath that, things will be happening, which we not necessarily privy to.
Christine, last week, Donald Trump met with Moon Jae-in, very highly public meeting, and then they had that what I would call a pretty extraordinary press conference that was unscripted for the most part. At that time, the South Korean government officials put out a statement that the summit had a 99.9% chance of going forward. And the very next day, when Moon Jae-in had gotten back to South Korea, Donald Trump, having just been briefed by John Bolton, by the way, he was the last person to talk to Trump. Trump came out and canceled the summit. And then it seemed like an emergency crisis situation had been created, what you called whiplash diplomacy. But then Moon Jae-in and Kim Jong-un met again quickly at the DMZ once again, this time on the northern side. They were seen hugging, kissing, clearly showing their own determination to keep this momentum going. It seemed to me to represent something really new in politics in the sense that the South Korean government was exercising a kind of relative sovereignty that a South Korean governments in the past had not enjoyed. And that perhaps was the thing that got it back on track, in addition to the desire by the DPRK and by Trump to actually have this. What's your take on all that?
Well, it was extraordinary because I was walking in the DMZ, in fact, with 1,200 South Korean women. We had organized a delegation of 30 women activists from 16 countries, including Russia and China and Japan, just to show the international community solidarity with the Korea peace process and with the Korean people. And so, you know, just as they were meeting, we were just walking in the DMZ, you know, basically supporting what they were doing. So when we returned to Seoul, we had learned that they had had this secret meeting. And I think, if anything, it's reflecting the desire of the Korean people on both sides of the DMZ to push forward, irrespective of whether the United States and Trump want to support or derail the peace process between North and South Korea. So, you know, it was really interesting to me because we had actually had set up a meeting with the U.S. Embassy in Seoul the morning after Trump had made that announcement. I mean, literally, it was 11 p.m. when we heard that on Thursday evening. And I actually got a call from one of the South Korean women whose father was pretty high up during the Kim Dae-jung administration, one of the ministers. And, you know, she's the one that called me to say, can you believe this? Moon Jae-in just landed in South Korea and we received this news. And so even the next morning, as we met with the U.S. Embassy in Seoul, you know, we asked them how they found out. And they basically found out by somebody from the South Korean government calling them. So clearly, there is, I think if anything, it just shows the tremendous fissures within the Trump administration between the kind of Mike Pence, John Bolton, hardline hawks. I mean, they're all hawks, but the more extreme hardliners versus those such as Mike Pompeo, who has been clearly laying the groundwork for this summit to take place.
Yeah. Tim Beal, there's so much here to talk about. There's the process itself, as Christine is examining it, discussing it. I mean, really extraordinary. By the way, Christine, before I go to Tim, were you on the south side of the DMZ or the north side?
We were on the south side of the DMZ, but I have to say that we broke new ground. We actually crossed something which is called the Unification Bridge. And this was the bridge that was built in 1998 on June 15th, and the day after was the day when the former CEO of Hyundai basically brought across that bridge 500 cattle during the end of North Korea's famine as a gesture of conciliation, reconciliation, and peace. It was the beginning of the Sunshine Era policy, and they had never allowed civilians to walk on foot. It had always been driven by car or by bus. And in fact, the last time when we crossed in 2015, we had been bussed over. So I think it really signaled a new day where I think both sides are very open to pursuing new territory. I mean, the fact that Moon Jae-in just crossed without any hesitation into North Korea to meet Kim Jong-un and you know, during obviously the April 27th summit when Kim Jong-un crossed. And Moon Jae-in stepped, you know, across the demarcation line. I just, you know, it's a very dynamic time, and I think extraordinarily hopeful for what is to come for the Korean Peninsula.
Yeah, that's the voice of Christine on. We're talking to Christine from Honolulu. She just got back from Korea, just got back from the DMZ. She was there with more than 1,000 women, international delegation promoting and supporting the peace process when that unexpected surprise meeting took place between Moon Jae-in and Kim Jong-un at the DMZ. We're also talking with Tim Beale. He is, his most recent book is Crisis in Korea. We're talking to Tim from New Zealand. Tim, I want to keep going with this part of the sort of topic, which is the relations between North Korea, South Korea, and the relations between the two leaders, because it seems that in response to Trump's sudden announcement that there's not going to be a summit, they could kind of quickly, almost casually, maybe casual is the wrong word, but quickly and confidently meet up with each other and to do it in a way that sort of changed the landscape once again in terms of the optics and the momentum in the politics. Talk about that.
Yeah, absolutely. In many ways, that second summit was, historically, we may look back at it and think of it more important than the Trump-Kim summit, if that actually happens. Because, as you said, it does mark a strengthening of South Korea's desire for independence and sovereignty from the United States. And that, of course, is, in many ways, a psychological thing. The South Koreans have been told for 70 years that they are subordinate, they have to serve American policy, etc., etc. And, you know, that's been accepted. So they're breaking free of that now. There's very little, many ways, that the United States can do about that, though there are powerful forces within South Korea who want to retain the subordinate position to the United States. But if Moon Jae-in and if civil society in South Korea moves forward, as it is doing, then it becomes very difficult for the United States to stop it. So this, in many ways, I think, is the big breakthrough. And what happens in Singapore is, to some extent irrelevant, because whatever happens in Singapore, we've had this meeting, as you say, sort of casual, the sort of meeting that should be happening all the time. And perhaps this is sending the precedent that they will get together much more often. Develop the personal relationship and develop the communications. And this is outside American control, and that's vitally important.
Christine, I'm wondering, let's look at the calendar too again, about, because there's a lot of symbolism, perhaps, you can tell us if you think so, between the dates. June 12th, the scheduled summit in Singapore comes just 3 days before the historic June 15th summit of 2000, when Kim Dae-jung and Kim Jong-il met, and there was the promise by both North and South Korea to begin the policy of rapprochement, the policy of détente, the policy of peaceful reunification. There was a sense of euphoria at that time and great optimism, because you had the government in Washington, the Clinton administration, also signaling that it too was contemplating normalizing relations with the DPRK. It was giving its, quote, blessings, so-called, to that process. What will happen this June 15th? Now we are, you know, this is going to be 18 years later, a very historic time for Koreans, North, South, and overseas Koreans.
Well, I mean, what they had declared at the Panmunjom Declaration on April 27th was that they would have civil society meetings on the 15th. And it sounds like that's back on track. So that's very heartening to know that the North and South Korean leaders recognize the importance for people-to-people engagement on both sides of the DMZ. And as for the significance of this, I think we have a situation where Moon Jae-in is just at the beginning of his term. We also have a situation where Moon Jae-in himself was in the Nomujun administration as the chief of staff. We have his senior officials that have been doing the kind of back channel and official diplomacy with the North Koreans, who have had experience during the Sunshine Policy years. So it's not like they are starting from scratch as they did during the Sunshine Policy, but it's sort of like a dusting off the shelf. It's sort of taking off the shelf plans that were underway and that essentially fell off a cliff when Lee Myung-bak and Park Geun-hye were in power during the kind of, the dark years of of South Korean history. And so I think that's the reason why there has been so much progress, that they have kind of moved at a breakneck pace. And the fact that Moon Jae-in still enjoys an 85% approval rating for his diplomacy with North Korea, it looks like there's going to be elections, I think, sometime in early June. And it looks like his party is going to sweep. And I think, you know, it's a new day for the Korean Peninsula. And we have to remember that, you know, on his trip to Asia, Donald Trump last November, I always bring it back to this Pew research poll that found that 3 out of 4 South Koreans said that they feared Donald Trump more than they did Kim Jong-un. And so I think that really paved the way for Moon Jae-in, you know, announcing after North Korea's last missile test that, you know, while he condemned North Korea's military provocation, he also sent a clear message to Washington that there will not be a Korean conflict without the approval of South Korea. And I think that was an extraordinarily bold pivot, an unnecessary pivot away from being under an unequal relationship with the United States. So I think Kim is absolutely right that this is long overdue. And I think it has a lot to do with the advancement of democracy in South Korea.
Yeah, I hear you on that. It's really remarkable. You know, all that, you know, Trump is gloating. He's responsible for all of this. His tough talk, tough sanctions, threatening North Korea with total annihilation from the podium of the General Assembly, using fire and fury rhetoric. It had just the opposite impact. In fact, South Koreans turned against Trump. I mean, of course, you have Lindsey Graham, Tim Beal, the senator here, Trump's golf buddy, who could cavalierly say, let's get the war going because, look, all the dying will be over there. We don't have to worry about it. This kind of extreme racism and xenophobic, so I don't know what you would call it. I mean, it's just awful. And you can see why it would have the impact of turning a Korean public opinion. Let's talk about substance now, about what the U.S. and we, as Christine has said, there's a divided White House here. John Bolton, Mike Pence, they're not really for this. There's probably a lot of other forces we know there are who are not for this. And what North Korea wants, and the approach of North Korea, which is a step-by-step synchronization, where the North Koreans have already taken numerous unilateral actions that would have to be perceived as concessions, and waiting in exchange for what the U.S. will do in terms of normalizing relations. And North Korea obviously means something different in some ways than what the U.S. seems to be suggesting about denuclearization. Where does it go substantially in terms of what the two sides can agree to?
That's the big question. I think, as I said earlier, that we might get a surface agreement and then perhaps secret negotiations under the radar. It's difficult to know what the North Korea, as far as I can see, really needs to retain its deterrent, because it can't depend on promises and on treaties and so forth, because, you know, they can be gone tomorrow and missiles are forever, as the expression goes. So it's difficult at this stage to see how these sort of irreconcilable objectives can be somehow appear to be reconciled. It's still very much up in the air. I mean, if it was a different president, if we could sort of switch the clock back, if this had happened under Clinton, and one doesn't have to be a fan of Clinton to regard him as a sort of more capable and serious negotiator than Trump, then one might be confident that some sort of mutual understanding could be arrived at. But with Trump, it's very much up in the air. We don't really know how much he understands of the situation, and he's very much prey, as we know, to the last voice in the ear. And this, I mean, Bolton quite clearly scuttled the, or attempted to scuttle the summit, and that led to this letter, which apparently they wrote together, canceling the summit. So that was directly done by Bolton. And then somebody else comes along, who knows, Pompeo perhaps, and says, no, we've got to do something else. And then Trump moves with that. So it's all rather unpredictable. It's not merely Trump himself, if Trump actually exists. Perhaps he doesn't, in a sense, really exist. He is just being manipulated by other people around him. So it's all rather, it's unpredictable. But I think, following on from Christine, since the Koreans have shown this sense of unity and, if you like, defiance, then this is going to underline, it's going to push the United States into, hopefully, into some sort of agreement.
Christine Ahn, do you agree with that?
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, basically, the train has left the station. The peace train has left the station between North and South Korea. And so it doesn't mean, though, that we don't have a role to play, especially the international community, especially those of us in the United States, to try to see through a conclusion of a 65-year conflict between the United States and the DPRK. We have known how the Sunshine Policy years were gravely impacted, had a deleterious effect on inter-Korean progress. And so, I think clearly it's a different day for the Korean Peninsula. It's a different day in South Korea with a president like Moon Jae-in. But, you know, the point, I mean, you know, we did get a chance to meet with the South Korean Ministry of Foreign Affairs before we left Seoul the other day. And, you know, I think the point that they make is the two have to go side by side, the denuclearization process and the peace treaty must go hand in hand. That, you know, and that's all we seem to hear in the United States and from the U.S. officials and the U.S. media is, you know, where is their commitment to denuclearization? And there will be no commitment to denuclearization as long as the North Koreans feel that their security is not guaranteed. And so there's going to have to be really tangible steps put forward that include the normalization of relations, that include, you know, the lifting of sanctions. And so we have to press our, put forward that perspective because it's so one way in this country. It's so biased that it should just be North Korea denuclearizing overnight. And that is just never going to happen.
All right. That's Christine Ahn. Christine is talking to us from Honolulu. She's the co-founder of the Korea Policy Institute, and she was the international coordinator of Women Crush DMZ. She just got back from the DMZ where she helped organize a large delegation of women advocating for, supporting, promoting the idea of peace coming to the Korean Peninsula. We've also been joined from New Zealand by author and professor Tim Beal. Tim's most recent book is Crisis in Korea. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
Today we continue our weekly series. It's every Tuesday, False Prophets, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism with Daniel Sankey. Daniel Sankey joins us from San Francisco. Daniel, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
I see that you're predicting an economic recession, which, of course, you will be right about. Because there will be an economic recession. It's just a matter of time. But what's interesting is that you are suggesting that student loan debt, I think it's now about $1.5 trillion, could actually be a catalyst for a 2008-style financial or banking crisis. Is that right? Am I saying it right?
Yeah, you're saying that correctly. I mean, obviously, we want to be careful not to prognosticate a little too much, but I honestly think that there are several factors in the student loan debt crisis, which make it kind of ripe for that sort of serious economic and financial crisis, the likes of which we've had before. You know, it has to have a couple of features, and one of them is size, and it's certainly big enough at $1.5 trillion. It's huge, right? It's a giant market, so it's big enough such that if it burst, that enough people would be impacted. Secondly is the lack of regulations around it. A lot of regulations were rolled back to allow students to take loans of virtually any size to finance student debt, so that there wasn't these controls in place that would say, oh, hey, no, you can't borrow that much. You can't afford it. Much like the mortgage meltdown in 2008, people were allowed to take out these huge loans they couldn't pay back. And then there are some other indicators as well. So, for example, investors kind of pressured and pushed the U.S. government to pass laws that make student loan debt unforgivable through bankruptcy. So that is to say, even if you declare bankruptcy, you'll still owe on those loans indefinitely. And that's really significant because the investors were signaling, hey, you know, we want to make sure we get ours. And if people can just kind of get out of it through bankruptcy, well, you know, we're not really wild about that. So to continue to drive investor confidence and investor funds into student loans, they input regulations and rules that would allow people to not get out from under them, even if they declare bankruptcy. So really, I wanted to talk a little bit about student debt, because obviously the downstream effect is students in insane amounts of debt that they can barely pay back, and a stagnating economy that isn't promising them the type of employment in which they could get out from under this debt. So those combinations kind of come together in this sort of perfect or imperfect storm that can create serious financial issues. And that's what I foresee. I think this is the kind of next big bubble that we're going to encounter somewhere down the line.
Daniel, there's a fascinating article in the Wall Street Journal that talks about this issue. I want to read just a couple of sentences. It says here, Mike Maru, a 37-year-old orthodontist, made a big investment in his education. As of Thursday, he owed $1,060,945.42 in student loans. He pays only $1,589.97 a month, not even enough to cover the interest. So his debt from 7 years at the University of Southern California grows by $130 a day. In two decades, his loan balance will be $2 million. It goes on to say that there are 101 people across the country who owe at least $1 million in federal student loans. 5 years ago, there were only 14 such people. But even more shocking, there are 2.5 million people who owe at least $100,000 in student loans. Now, if even a declaration of bankruptcy doesn't vacate those loans, what happens when a person is just simply unable to pay them?
Yeah, and you can see the predatory nature of the institution, right? He's going to be paying back those loans forever, right? And they're going to keep growing. So it's this cycle where it's not like some kind of investment where you eventually pay it back and then you're debt-free and you move on. The bank makes their money. You make the money off of the investment in your education, and, you know, everybody benefits. The idea is that you should be in debt to them forever. And that's really what we're seeing here, as well as the increase in interest rates. I took out student loans when I went to college, but that was quite some time ago. And since then, the interest rates on these loans have crept up and up and up. And I was surprised when I was helping a younger sister-in-law, apply for student loans. And I was kind of walking her through the process and explaining it to her how much higher the interest rates were and how much less was subsidized than back when I did it. And that is a general trend that we're seeing. And the reason why we're seeing that is because these banks that are making these loans see the risks. And if the risks are increasing, and believe me, they have very smart, very well-attuned analysts looking at the risk of default, looking at the risk in the market, they're going to creep up that interest rate a little bit to make sure that they make their money and that they cover the losses from the pending defaults. The issue is, though, that, you know, as Brian mentioned, there will, of course, be a recession at some point. These markets are cyclical. And when that happens, people like Mike Maru and the many others who have student loans in excess of $100,000 won't be able to pay even that back. And so you're going to have this huge debt of $2 million that's not getting paid back. Now, right now, that looks like an asset on the balance sheets of all these banks. That looks like potential for making money. They could sell this debt to another financial institution and profit off of it. They could trade it on the open market. They could create derivatives on it and things like that. But once people stop paying it, suddenly it's this massive liability. And their ability to pay it is going to be directly tied to the cyclical nature of the market. And we will inevitably have a downturn. And that's when there's going to be a lot of people left holding this huge bag that, rather than being an asset, is this huge liability. And for those reasons, I think that this is the next kind of significant financial crisis.
50 years ago, when somebody, I'm from Rochester, New York. My family, my siblings, everybody went to State University of New York at one place or another, number of campuses. I think the tuition was about $600 a semester or something like that.
Oh, sure.
It's hard for people now, when we look at colleges that cost so much money to go to college, to actually consider this. I mean, this was not free education, but it was certainly affordable education. And the problem now, Daniel, is unlike then, in the 1960s or early 1970s, when you got out of college, even if you didn't go to college, you could get a job that had a decent pay, and you were going to get benefits. You're going to have health care. You're going to probably have a pension. Now, almost no one has a pension, and all of these young people are graduating with tens of thousands of dollars in student debt, or $100,000, or in the case of some people, hundreds of thousands, or even a million. And unless they graduated with a specialized degree in an area that there's a labor shortage, in all likelihood, people are going to come out and just be scratching for any kind of work. And if you have a Bachelor of Arts degree, it's not going to help you get any of those jobs.
Yeah, and I think it's all relative as well. So even if you're able to secure a really good, high-paying job, like an orthodontist or someone in the legal profession or something like that, your payments on this massive debt are going to be equally large. And so, sure, you're making a lot more money, but it's just immediately going out of your pocket into the pocket of the banks who made the loan to begin with. So that's the name of the game, right? I mean, I look at the situation of millennials nowadays who are, you know, graduating from college and have been over the last 5 years. And the economic situation, I mean, it's almost a proverb that you end up working part-time at a Starbucks or part-time at retail or something like that, even though you have a college degree, even though you worked hard, because there's just no opportunity out there. And the vast majority of these young people have financed their education with student loans. They believed in the kind of mythology that they were told, which is, hey, if you go to college and you work hard, that's just going to be a ticket for stability and good jobs and opportunity later. That's something that, you know, their parents had drilled into their heads and they passed on to them. And, you know, when I went to college, that was more or less true. But now I'm looking at their situation and it's completely different. And they're completely disaffected with it. They're trying to pay student loans, working part-time at Starbucks and working two or three jobs with insane rent, with limited opportunities. And all it takes is just a little economic downturn, a little percentage points down, a few percent. And that can have huge impacts on the ability to pay back loans, huge impacts on corporate profitability, and kind of rumblings through the whole system. So it's a very precarious situation. You know, these young people are not getting the type of jobs and opportunities that they were promised, no matter how hard they try. And so they're just kind of stuck and stagnating, where, you know, almost all their income is going towards rent, going towards paying back of student loans, going towards back to these other companies that just kind of take their percentage from their meager earnings. You know, it's a very fragile situation.
Financial policy analyst Daniel Sankey is our guest. Every Tuesday, we look at the big economic stories of the day. We're talking in the beginning part of this segment about student debt, its impact on individuals, its impact on families, and its potential impact on the health of the economy overall. John Kiriakou, I'm always interested in this subject, but I'm interested now because we're talking about it now, and I'm looking around. Do you know how many people owe student debt?
Wow. No, I have no idea.
Daniel Sankey, do you know?
I don't. Go ahead.
I don't know. No, I do know. 42 million as of 2 years ago, and the number is increasing. So
what is that? That's like 12% of the entire population of the United States.
Yeah. 42 million people are in debt to about $1.5 trillion. It was $1.3 trillion when this study came out. 42 million people. And because of the way the laws were written in the 1990s, when student debt was essentially privatized fully, even the federal government-sponsored debt privatized for private banks, and it's the only debt that you cannot declare bankruptcy on. You can't go to court and say, Chapter 11 court, and say, I can't pay this bill, relinquish it, I'll have bad credit for 7 years, I'll rebuild, I'll start over. So Daniel, right now, a lot of people who had student debt from the past, who are now entering their retirement years, Social Security years, when you're 62, they are paying student debt because their Social Security payments are being garnished in order to pay these banks.
Incredible.
You're taking this debt to the grave.
Yeah, that's what's really amazing, is these public benefits that are for people in low income situations or retired people who have, decided to finally not work anymore and actually enjoy a life that's all their own. And they can actually go after and take unemployment benefits, take Social Security benefits out of their hands, which is just robbing some of the most vulnerable and most poor people. Other interesting statistics on student loan debt. I mean, over 10% of student loans are in some state of delinquency or default. That's not a healthy number. That's over one in 10 people are behind on their student loans. And if you think about it, it makes sense. Given the state of the economy, are you going to pay rent and buy food or pay for your student loans? Well, of course, you'd like to do all three. But if pressed to only choose two, of course, you're going to choose things like rent and food and gas to get to work, public transportation to get to your job, because you need those things. And the moment you stop paying your landlord, things can go downhill real quick. Whereas, the student loan situation takes longer and there's a levy involved. But the whole point, too, of garnishing people's wages is also to create a kind of debtor's prison, for lack of a better word, because the federal government can continue to garnish wages, can continue to go after them and grab them. And they charge penalties and interest on top of failed payments or delinquencies between when you owed the money and when they seized it. So that kind of balloons up and continues to add to it. So the idea is essentially that they constantly have some kind of legal right to just sort of, whack you like a cash pinata every once in a while and take what funds they can from you while you sort of scrape by, where you're just permanently passing over a certain percentage of it, as in the case of the people on Social Security who've retired, who are still paying even though, they've long since ceased working. So, it's a really desperate situation. And that's the sort of predatory nature we saw in 2008, right, with the loans that were being made, people who couldn't afford them, people who were going to be in debt forever. People are getting taken advantage of by, savvy lenders that just saw the opportunity to profit. And that's kind of what we're seeing here as well. It's a really kind of disgusting situation that goes back to the fact that education is now largely privatized and it's for profit and it's about making money and it's not about creating a citizenry that's well-informed and equipped to function in a, free and democratic society.
Daniel, this is obviously an economic time bomb. So what happens when we get to a point where there are just too many people who are unable to pay back their loans? How does this impact the larger economy?
Yeah, what you're going to see is these defaults are going to cause interest rates to go up. You're going to see panic as investors are unable to recoup losses. I, every couple of months, get a letter from, I took out student loans, saying that, your student loans have been sold to this other company. So they're just passing around loans and selling them to one another. That market will dry up as well. I'm not saying it's going to be the sort of thing that, can end financial institutions the way 2008 can. I think the market needs to be a lot more wild and chaotic for that to happen. But I think what we're going to see is ultimately students are, and those with those debts are the ones that are going to be gone after. And you're going to have lenders aggressively going after these groups of people. You're going to see them legislating for even stricter regulations and rules around their ability to get money back. And you're going to see a huge downturn in investment as well, as a lot of people have made a lot of money off of these student loans. They're considered fairly safe because there's a government subsidy portion of it, and you're kind of doing it in partnership with the state. So it's not just a speculative investment all on your own, which incidentally, you think of Sally Mae and Freddie Mac, that kind of sort of public-private sector crossover where you have a public institution kind of assisting in private profit, which is sort of what see here. So, you know, ultimately what's going to happen is people that have student loan debt are the ones who are going to get really stuck with the bill. And you're going to see a lot of unrest, a lot of anger and frustration at the unfairness, and a lot of very aggressive lenders doing everything they can to recoup their losses and to try to keep themselves afloat. And then, you know, it'll ripple through the rest of the economy, right? If investors are scared and they're not able and they're not profiting there, they're going to pull back their investments from other areas. They're going to be more conservative with where they spend their money. And that's going to impact the creation of jobs. That's going to impact the creation of expanding the economy. So it's definitely going to have a ripple effect. I think we're kind of ripe for it from a political situation. Young people already are overwhelmed and frustrated with the education system in the United States, to say nothing of the healthcare system. You know, the Bernie Sanders movement, a big part of it was around free public education, which was a huge rallying cry for these young people who were under all this debt. And I think this sort of downturn will just continue to spark that. I think it'll continue to spark a lot of outrage and political engagement from these young people who are sick of having to be in debt for the rest of their lives simply because they wanted to be educated.
That's the voice of Daniel Sankey. Daniel's a financial policy analyst in Northern California. We talk to him every Tuesday about the big economic stories of the week. I want to suggest to people, if you want to learn more about student debt, there was an important series of articles done, or a primary article actually, by investigative reporters James B. Steele and also Lance Williams. One of the points that I think is important that their study brought out is that student debt, and again, we're talking about 42, 43 million Americans who are in student debt, it's a microcosm, too, of the United States. It's a story of the haves and the have-nots. It's about class division. And I think this is extremely important and not really, you sort of alluded to it, Daniel, but I want to come back to it. When you're 17, 18 years old, the question of whether you can go to school with financial aid and, I mean, with loans or without loans is completely dependent on factors other than yourself. Do your parents, does your family have or does it not have enough money to pay these very high tuitions and also room and board? If you don't have the money, well, if your parents don't have the money, if your family doesn't have the money, you have to take out student debt. And now we have 42 million Americans whose family did not have enough money, so they took out student loans, and now they're saddled with $1.5 trillion in debt. And that's going to be with them at every step of the way for at least multiple years. That means when they get their salary, their contract, their wages, whatever it is, and sometimes it's lean years, you have to pay this debt back because there's no relief from it, where the young people whose families had the money don't have to pay it back. So it's a tale of two Americas. And again, replicated over and over and over again, not because of the merits of the individual. You know, that's what we're told about capitalism, is that the people who work hard and or study hard and put their shoulder to the wheel, the people who are, quote, smart and hardworking, they're the ones who are going to make it. But the fact of the matter is, when you're 18 years old and you have no real job history of your own, whether or not you're absorbing this huge debt or not is completely dependent on the financial or class status of your parents. That's the reality. And so you have class division, you have the microcosm of racism or institutionalized racism being replicated over and over again, and it's primary. It's a primary way that this will be replicated, the division of the country between haves who don't have to take out student debt and have-nots who do.
I think also we saw a huge ballooning of the have-nots who do just 10 years ago, because when everybody was losing their homes or their jobs or their opportunities because the economy was tanking, well, that's when you dip into your savings. That's when you dip into funds maybe you put aside for your college education or your child's college education. And the reason you do that is to survive, because you have to, because you need it today and you can't wait for 10 years from now or whatever when your kid needs to go to school. So I think that's a contributing factor why we see this huge ballooning debt. But I think also we need to think about education and how our perception of education has changed as a society. Originally, the idea of public education all the way through high school was that if we're going to have a society where everyone has the opportunity to participate in government, where everybody can vote, where everyone can be politically engaged, then we need to make sure everyone's educated, because that's a huge responsibility, because people need to understand and think critically and look at the world in a variety of different ways so they can make informed decisions. That was the primary purpose of education, was to have an informed citizenry. Secondarily was to have a job, and that was also important. But now what you've seen is this shift, this privatization of education, where being informed and critically thinking and a conscious citizen is really just kind of idealistic. The purpose of your education is to have a job, is so you can work in retail or work in hotel service or whatever. And a big part of that privatization goes hand in hand with that new perception, which is simply that, look, this is a mill for workers. We pump out people who can do simple menial tasks, and we charge as much as we can for it to make as much as we can. And we're seeing a dramatic shift in our society and how we perceive learning and education and really how we perceive human worth. And there needs to be a huge fight back and a huge turning back towards that original idea, was that informed citizens participating in their government should be equipped for it, and the government should be providing for them to be equipped for it. And that's an essential part of it, public education.
There's one more feature. I know we have other subjects, but this one is so big and affects so many people. I'm glad we're focusing on it. There's another element of this that I think is hidden, which is that the federal government also generates money from the issuance of these loans, even if the loans are held by private banks. Again, going back to this study by James B. Steele and Lance Williams, investigative reporters, and this was from 2 years ago, the federal loans issued between 2007 and 2012 currently are projected to generate $66 billion in income for the government, according to the Government Accountability Office report. So what does that mean? That means these people are paying a tax. It's really the same thing as a tax.
That's exactly what it is.
It's $66 billion in taxes paid by young people for the privilege of having gone to school.
Which is also predatory.
Which is predatory. And then we have the federal government now giving this $1.4 trillion in tax relief to the very, very rich mainly. Meanwhile, young people, because they went to school, are generating $66 billion in income slash also known as a tax. So you have what's going on, Daniel, a redistribution of wealth. Not the way the conservatives always, you know, are up in arms about it, that the rich are having their wealth redistributed to the poor. On the contrary, young people, including working class young people mainly, because those are the people who are taking out student debt, they're generating income to supplement the loss of income from the federal government, because the federal government is giving more than that amount back to the rich in the form of tax breaks.
Yeah, absolutely. And those payments to student loans, those outstanding debts, can be sold by the federal government to private industry, who can then speculate on it, who can trade it to one another, and who can benefit from the payments. So it's really a privatization of these public funds. And it's a double tax, right? Because those young people already paid taxes, whether at the state level through their day-to-day purchases or annually at the state level, or at the federal level through their annual taxes that they have to pay. You know, they're paying taxes, they're giving money to the system. And the idea that they need to take out some kind of private slash public debt to further gain the public services that their tax dollars have created is absurd. It makes absolutely no sense, and it's just simply a double tax. That's been a huge part of profitability. I mean, you know, it's beyond the scope of this show, but we could talk about the privatization of what was public before as a way of gaining profit, which is really just robbing. It's just seizing what everyone owns and giving it to just a small group of people for personal profit. There's nothing innovative about it. There's nothing particularly brilliant or talented about it. It's just simple robbery through, you know, a pseudo legal process.
And tell me a little bit about the policy side of this. Is anybody on Capitol Hill focused on this terrible issue? Is anybody proposing legislation or trying to do something to correct this? Because by all accounts, it looks like we're headed for a major economic crisis, and it's going to be triggered by these student loans.
Well, certainly people like Senator Elizabeth Warren and others have been very vocal and have raised it before. People like Bernie Sanders, of course, who I mentioned earlier, have as well. They're definitely minority voices on Capitol Hill, that's for sure. And it also is a huge challenge, because once debt has swelled to this size, it's not just a simple thing. You know, you could engage in some kind of massive debt forgiveness, but that would have huge economic consequences down the line, both in terms of investor confidence, and it would let a tremendous amount of air out of this bubble, which I think is kind of the point. I think that the private sector really wants to see these balloons blow up out of control to the point where even legislators who believe in things like free education balk at the size of this issue and the size of this problem and the ease at which we can sort of simply legislate or regulate this problem away. At this point, there's a huge amount of money owed. It's a purely speculative market. The banks don't have the money. They just have the liabilities. The students don't have the money. They're desperately trying to get by. And so what you have is these kind of made up figures of student loans, which are liabilities clothed as assets, clothed as liabilities. And so I think it's a huge challenge. And really, while I applaud a lot of the rhetoric of people like Elizabeth Warren and others, I think it really takes a united grassroots movement of students who are also demanding this, because the money is there. I mean, we spend more than half of our federal tax dollars on war, on violence, you know, blowing up people in other countries. We can certainly take a portion of that to pay down student debt and take advantage of this tremendous wealth we have to benefit people. But that's going to require a fight back, and that's going to require a shift in people's consciousness to where they stand up and say, no, I don't want to finance the next war in, you know, DPRK or whatever country we've decided is our enemy. I want to go to school instead. And it's unacceptable to us now as a society that we should be spending our money this way. That's going to take a lot of work and a lot of organizing and a lot of change in political consciousness. But I think it's really the only way we can actually effectively fight back against this.
Daniel, we have less than 1 minute left. You mentioned a grassroots movement that's clearly, clearly needed. This will not change without a grassroots movement. It was, as you mentioned before, a big part of the support for Bernie Sanders in the 2016 election campaign. Hillary Clinton was not there. Of course, the Republicans were not there. And I just wonder, will it become, and under what circumstances, will it become like a major issue in the 2020 elections?
I think it will become an issue. I mean, look how quickly Bernie Sanders was able to gather support coming around these progressive issues. The truth is that Capitol Hill is deeply out of touch with the vast majority of United States citizens and Americans think. And we need to realize that and realize that as a society, 70% of us want socialized healthcare. As a society, a huge number of us want free education and don't see why we need to pay so much for it. And that is a real opportunity. So if we can get another voice to rally around, whether it's a Sanders or a Warren or who knows who, this can really galvanize people. But it's going to take a lot of work and a lot of pressure from below. But I think we're ripe for it. You know, I think this Trump presidency has done so much to delegitimize the government in people's eyes that they're ready to demand a society for them, a society that actually provides for their needs and doesn't prop up, you know, disgraces like the Trump administration, which we've had to deal with for the last year or so.
All right. We're going to leave it right there. We've been talking with Daniel Sankey. Every Tuesday, Daniel joins us in the segment called False Profits, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism with Daniel Sankey. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.